When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. This is Gargi, and today I have with me Judith Mizrahi-Barak. She teaches at the University of Montpellier Trois in France. She's interested in English and postcolonial literatures. She's the author of numerous articles on Caribbean region and Indian Ocean and the diaspora writings from the regions. I'm also joined by Ashutosh Bhardwaj. He is a bilingual journalist, fiction writer, and literary critic. As a journalist, he has traveled across central India and documented the condition of tribal regions caught between the insurgency and the police violence. They have together edited this book called Kala Pani Crossings, Revisiting 19th Century Migrations from India's Perspective, published with Routledge late last year, and have very kindly accepted to talk to me about this book. Hello, Judith. Hello, Ashutosh. How are you?
Hi, Gargi.
Yes, good.
Thanks for inviting us.
So my first question is always about the genesis, but before I do that, your Google bio tells me that you've had two very different journeys. How did you come together, and how did the whole group of people who have written for this book come together?
Yes, it's always interesting to get into, you know, genesis of books and ideas. And in this case, I mean, it was a kind of, you know, leap in the dark and a series of coincidences and happy happenings. As well. So that was, it all happened in Shimla, in fact. So I was invited the first time to Shimla as a visiting professor for a short while back in March 2018. And so as part of my visiting professorship, I had, you know, a talk to give. And so I gave a talk on something I had just started working on. That is Kala Pani Crossings, and I know we'll come back on that later on in the discussion. But my suggestion, you know, I was trying to invite people to reconsider and to change their perspective, because I had been working for many, many years with diaspora scholars, and I was interested in, you know, since I had started coming to India for, you know, quite a long time, since 2008, I was interested in, you know, that shift, in fact, in the perspective. So when I arrived in Shimla, I gave that talk, and Ashutosh was one of the fellows at the Institute of Advanced Study in Shimla. And so he obviously, you know, got interested, and we started talking and developing a conversation. Then we stayed in touch, we continued the conversation. And then there was that possibility that we could, you know, co-organize a seminar, since it seems that there was some interest about the theme of Kala Pani Crossings and the shifting of the perspective. so that we could organize an international seminar. And then the IAS actually accepted the proposal, and it all started from there. So the seminar actually happened in 2019, so a year after we had met. And it was by invitation only. So we invited, you know, specific people, people I had been working with for quite a few years. But generally, it was scholars, it was diaspora scholars. So scholars who had been used to working on migrations from India from their diasporic perspectives. So there were, you know, stellar scholars in Australia, in Mauritius, in the US and elsewhere, but we made a proposal to them. Would you be able to reconsider, in fact, all the work you have done and reconsider from a different perspective? And we would, you know, get together. So it was not exactly a conference. It was not, it was an international seminar. We did open it up to other people apart from the invited guests. So that was also very interesting. And so that's how the discussion, you know, started. And we'll say a bit more about, you know, how the seminar actually went and also what it led to. But that is probably another question.
Ashutosh, you would like to add something?
Well, let me add the India chapter to the what Judith has said. So when she visited the Shimla Institute as a visiting professor, I was a fellow there, as she has said. So I was hugely impressed by this French woman. But till then, we had not developed any friendship or any bond. She was just a stranger. So I was impressed by this French woman who had immense interest in India and who I soon realized knew more about India and Indian issues than most Indians I knew of. Third, she had a genuine empathy towards what we call the marginalized and the depressed classes. She had been working on the Dalits, and she wanted to understand more and more about the Adivasis. Adivasi was the issue on which I had already worked over the last several years before I came to Shimla. So this formed the basis of an intellectual partnership in our initial months. And as the conversations grew between both of us, please note that I was in Shimla and she was in France. So our conversations were mostly on emails. There were only occasional phone calls. So we were exploring certain themes through our emails. And then during that exploration, that examination, we came across the idea of the Kalapani and the migration of the indentured laborers from India. So this is how. Now, Judith said the conference took place in 2019. I would also add it took place in 2019 September. So we are meeting in 2018 March, and the conference takes place over one and a half years after that. So it shows how much time that went into the doing the groundwork or spade work of this conference. So it wasn't and during this period both of us were in different continents. We were only conversing through our through emails, through phone calls. And then Judith has said that once we had some idea ready, we then started inviting scholars from all over the world, some Indians as well, who are located in India, who have done work on the diaspora theme. And then this is how we all came together. So it all began, you can say, on a March evening when we met in Shimla.
Yeah, that does sound like a good story. So let's come back to the book. What were some initial ideas when you started writing this book? When the book started to come together?
Yeah, so in fact, it's a direct follow-up on the seminar that happened in Shimla. Because we had brought this group together, so it was a group of about, you know, 20, 30 people. well, 20 speakers, and then there was, you know, audience as well. So there were papers, the papers were discussed, there were, you know, discussions and debates. And we wanted to keep a trace of all this, and also give an opportunity to people so that they could actually improve and include some of the discussions and some of the conversations that happened during the seminar in written form. So again, I mean, the basis of the proposal that we made to these people and these scholars was to try and reverse the perspective, you know, because they had been, you know, working from diaspora mostly, but also we were interested in the conversation between diaspora scholars and Indian scholars, or at least scholars based in India. And so, so I wanted to, you know, break the mold in a way that, you know, a lot of people feel very comfortable in. That is, some people work in the diaspora, some people work in India, and there is, you know, there isn't necessarily a conversation between the scholars, even though they should be connected through the idea of migration, migration away from India or back to India. So this notion of migration was quite at the, you know, at the basis, at the beginning of the conversation as well. And then in order to make a book and to produce a book and a co-edited volume, of course, it needs another kind of effort. Of course, you need a publisher. But in order to convince the publisher that it's going to be a worthy book and that it's going to be interesting and to sell, as well, you need to, you know, put a good group together. You need to go through double blind peer reviewing. You need to do the pre-selection. You need to do the revising. You need, I mean, it's not only, it's definitely not the proceedings of the seminar. It is, I mean, some people sent, you know, their articles without having worked on the written form, and so those were not included in the book. Some chapters had to be revised, some chapters had to be, you know. So it's been I mean, as an academic, maybe it was kind of a, you know, a new thing for Ashutosh as a journalist, but as an academic, we are used to that kind of thing. It is part of the job we do in order to push people, in fact, to support people so that they can actually give the best of what they can give. And so there's been, you know, a lot of work on the chapters themselves as well. And so it's definitely not, you know, proceedings of a conference. I mean, this is absolutely not done anymore. I mean, it doesn't have any value, you know. And then, of course, we had this introduction. So the introduction reflects, in a way, I mean, the conversations that Ashutosh was talking about, you know, just a few minutes ago. So across continents and across across disciplines as well, you know, he being a journalist and me an academic, and of course, he being more than a journalist and me being more than an academic. I mean, obviously, you know, so this has been developing as well. And this is probably, I mean, it was also linked to, you know, the potential previous interests that Ashutosh mentioned. And you probably want to add something as well, Ashutosh.
But before that, before adding about my interest, I would like to add here, Gargi, the idea of the book or idea of an academic output perhaps was, not perhaps, it was certainly ingrained in the very conversations about the seminar that I and Judith took had earlier. So we were clear right from the beginning that it will not be a mere seminar. It will not be a mere conference where we are inviting some scholars to read their papers. We were certain about it that this will have, it has to have some concrete academic output. So I guess this is how it differentiates our entire endeavor. from many such conferences and seminars that take place elsewhere. We knew what we were going to achieve, what we intended, and I'm glad that we achieved that, or we realized that as well.
Yeah. And coming now to you, Ashutosh, if you allow me to ask you, this has been published with the academic press, and it is mostly written by people who are working somehow associated with academia. You work as a journalist and a writer. Why did you choose to be involved in what seems like, what is this more than journalist that you are, that Judith mentioned, that you're more than a journalist and she's more than an academic. So how did that, because they are two different fields, aren't they?
Yeah, they are different fields, but let's not forget that I was already a fellow at an academic institution when I met Judith, or when this idea was germinated. I had already, if not left journalism, I was already on a sabbatical to do some kind of academic work. Of course, my academic work, Judith still doesn't count that as an academic. What I believe is my academic. For Judith, I'm still doing some kind of creative or journalistic work. So yeah, she still doesn't count. She does not rank me among the high, doesn't take me to the high pedestal of academia, what she believes it to be, but nevertheless, yeah. So yeah, I was trying to do some kind of academic work, which I thought is academic work. So in that way, during that phase of mine, when I was trying to do what I thought was academic work, I met Dr. Judith, Professor Judith. And as I said, I was impressed by her. And then there were several factors. Number one, there was a genuine interest in me. I had worked on Adivasi. I had written a book on the Adivasis. I had also, as a part of a journalist, been actively involved with various Dalit issues. So when Judith brought the whole idea of the indentured laborers on the table, I realized that this is in a continuation of what I had been working so far. In fact, later in the conversation, I'll just tell you a tale about the Adivasi indentures. So yeah, but coming to your question, so partly her personality, partly my own interest, and then the thrill of being into a new field, a new adventure. So all these factors took me to this joint effort, which eventually came out in the form of a book.
The thrill of the new adventure, I mean, was there for me too, but it was also there for the scholars who actually participated in the seminar first, and also in the book, because they were also stepping out of their usual comfort zones. And this stepping out of one's, you know, own comfort zone, I mean, is something that is thrilling in many ways, and also, you know, support, I mean, a lot of us, I mean, particularly, you know, Ashutosh and me in this context. So I think this is also what impressed the scholars and the contributors of the book, that they realized that they were able to move out of their comfort zones as well, you know. And so this is also why, and maybe I'm anticipating to probably one of the other, you know, questions that we can discuss. This whole question of the Kalapani, you know, you were asking a question about the content of the book and how, you know, how did the content get together. So a lot of people have been asking us, you know, but why did you call it Kalapani, you know, crossings? And of course, Ashutosh always, you know, laughs at me because I'm still not quite there with my Hindi accent. So, but that's fine. It was also all meant to unsettle a certain number of, you know, customs, things we take for granted. And so shifting from the diaspora perspective to India's perspective, was also something that, you know, was at the heart of the endeavor and adventure.
And that does lead very nicely into my next question, which is about the title of this book. And as far as I have understood, you have used Kalapani almost as like a keyword. Usually in India, where I'm also from, it is now stands for the southern coast, at the islands at the southern border of India. But you have used it for the entirety, taking even to till the Marquesan Islands, Reunion, Mauritius. If one was to say, wouldn't oceanic humanities better suit this purpose? What would you respond to that? How would you respond to that?
Well, oceanic humanities is a much bigger field. Kalapani crossings, I mean, literally, it means crossing of the dark waters. So historically speaking, it's not particularly connected. I mean, or it shouldn't be, only connected to the Andamans and freedom fighters, you know, who were sent to the cellular jail in Port Blair at the beginning of the century, at the beginning of the, you know, 20th century. So it is true that this is the meaning that Kalapani crossings has taken on in India. But in fact, the interesting thing is that it is not the meaning that is given to the phrase from the diaspora. In the diaspora and among diaspora scholars and people who have been working on Indo-Caribbean matters, Indo-Caribbean topics, literature, history, etc., when they use the sentence or the phrase Kalapani crossings, they mean the migration away from India, crossing the Kalapani, moving away from Ganga waters, and potentially shedding their caste, because the caste element, you know, has been at the heart of the conversations during the seminar and in the book as well. And there is that, I mean, one chapter particularly on that by Supana Sengupta, who reconsiders in fact all this. So so in fact it's shifting back to India, you know, this Kalapani crossings, I mean, phrase has been traveling back and forth between India and the diaspora, Fiji, Mauritius, the Caribbean, South Africa, etc., with different meanings. And each country, each cultures, each, you know, set of scholars potentially have, you know, a different content, a different image content for it. So it's also that desire to shift it back into, you know, onto the Indian plate in a way, and see what it has become. You know, see what that expression, how it has traveled and how it has gained new meanings. What do you make of those new meanings? How do you, you know, get back to and interpret, in fact, the journey that the word has been doing?
One more thing, Gargi, here. The words like oceanic humanities, oceanic studies, they are dry. They are flavorless. The word Kalapani in India, it has a harshness, a hardness to it. So we deliberately chose this word. And also Kalapani is in India, it is being used only in a particular context, the cellular jail of the Andamans. We wanted to also question that the usage as well, that why Kalapani should be used only for this context. So there were a couple of factors. One, the Kalapani hits you hard. It shakes you, Kalapani. I mean, it has some resonance among Indians. This word has a cultural memory. Oceanic humanities, oceanic studies, it does not have any memory. So therefore, so it's deliberately that we chose a Hindi word for an academic book that is largely addressed to the international audience.
Yeah.
And also it is addressed to an Indian audience as well. Yeah, I mean, it is, you know, both parts of the dialogue. Yes.
Certainly. I meant that despite being addressed to the international audience, we decided to have a Hindi word here.
Yes.
So the whole title of the book is Kalapani Crossing, Revisiting Migration from India's Perspective. So now I want to come to India's perspective. First, why is there a need for it? And if you could also talk about what does it mean? What does India's perspective mean? Is it talking about the perspective of the Indian government, which is also sometimes often in the news when it comes to diaspora? Or is it mean shifting the thing from the diaspora to the citizens of this country as in Indians who are living in India?
Yes, I mean, it all started from, you know, the realization, I mean, several years ago that whenever I was invited, you know, to India and gave, you know, talks in at different institutions, etc. I mean, I sometimes picked the topic of the migrations and then slowly started to speak about the migrations, you know, from India. And because I'm a Caribbean scholar, you know, first and foremost, I was constantly insisting on the Indian component of Caribbean literature, you know, Indo-Caribbean literature. And then slowly I realized that whenever I was talking about Indo-Caribbean literature, there was only generally one big name that was coming out, and that was V.S. Naipaul. But all the other, you know, younger generation Indo-Caribbean writers, I mean, not many people in India, even among the academic audiences, I mean, knew about them. And when I started, because I never, you know, deal with literature in only a literary way, for me, it's always, you know, literature in context, obviously. So I always go back to the history, go back to the context, etc. And when I had those audiences of faculty, academics, students as well in front of me, I realized that they did not know anything about those migrations, even among, you know, university professors. I mean, if they were not within that specific field, not many people knew about it. Students certainly did not know about it. And then I got confirmation that it was not part of the, you know, it was not on the syllabi. It was not taught in the schools. It was not taught at the universities, etc. So for me, speaking of the Indian perspective, it's not so much the government, not so much the Indian states, but definitely the general public, readers, academics, students, potentially, you know, teenagers, I mean, who have, those migrations are absolutely not on their radar. So this was my, you know, intention. I mean, it can sound very pretentious, very presumptuous to want to modify the perspective in another country that is not even your own country. But sometimes you achieve things as a foreigner, you achieve things from the outside that are difficult to achieve, you know, from the inside. But of course, I have allies, you know, so I need a lot of allies, and all my, you know, Indian scholar friends and friends are allies in this, you know, endeavor. So for me, this is what I have, you know, in mind about the Indian perspective. You know, it's a very general kind of thing, but maybe, you know, Ashutosh probably has another notion of what the Indian perspective means.
For the last several decades, it was after the economic liberalization in the 1990s, it was believed that the Indian government should address the diaspora because they have enormous economic financial potential. But in the last 10-15 years or so, we have also seen that how the government is trying to address the religious aspect of this diaspora, and how the diaspora has been able to construct a Hindu identity abroad, which is then helping the Hindutva elements or the saffron party back in India. The one example is that when Rishi Sunak becomes a British England's prime minister, many Indians immediately started claiming as one of their own as a faithful Hindu. But the story is not this. I didn't want to tell you this story. The story I want to tell here is that right from the 19th century, the diaspora, had, the indentured laborers, till then we were not even calling them diasporas, the laborers had been carriers of a distinct Hindu identity, distinct in Hindu culture. For instance, Totaram Sanatya, who wrote one of the earliest works, earliest accounts of an indentured laborer in Fiji, how many people know that he started organizing Ram Leela, that is, the Ramayana. He started staging the Ramayana in Fiji. In the 1940s, when some RSS members, which is Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, which is the parent body of the Bharatiya Janata Party, the organization which is heading India, the Prime Minister comes from both RSS as well as the BJP. So in the 1940s, when some RSS members, volunteers, they travel to Africa on a ship, they hold an RSS meeting on the ship, and when they reach Kenya, they immediately start holding RSS meetings, which are called as Shakha in Kenya. And very soon from Kenya to several areas, countries of East Africa, these Hindu organizations start having their sway. So there is a history of this Hindutvization or a Hinduization of the diaspora. It has not occurred immediately. It needs to be addressed that if a lot of people are being able to claim Rishi Sunak as a faithful Hindu, there's a history of at least 100 years, maybe more than that. So the diaspora has been, right from the days of the indentured laborers, has been a career of Hindu identity. Unfortunately, this aspect has not been properly studied so far.
And also we can add that, you know, it's interesting in the case of Rishi Sunak, because he's not, I mean, Indian. I mean, he is definitely a person of Indian, you know, descent. But also, because a lot of people have been, you know, making that distinction between the old diaspora and the new diasporas, speaking about, you know, Indians. But in his case, in the case of his family, I mean, his family actually moved to East Africa, as is, you know, well known now. So in fact, he is a descendant. He's definitely a descendant. He's almost a descendant of the Kalapani crossings, because his family actually went, you know, to East Africa, Kenya, etc. And then only in the 1960s, early 1960s, so 30 years later, 30 years after having left India, they actually moved to the UK. So he's British born, but he's not Indian, even though he claims he is, you know, he is Hindu. But in fact, he goes back and his family goes back to the Kalapani crossings descendants. And so that old, you know, diaspora that a lot of people in India had thought, you know, would have to be swept under the carpet because they were considered, even if it's not true, but they were considered as being only low caste, only, you know, widows, only poor people or poor Brahmins, you know, even though it was a, you know, a minority of it. But those people went to the plantations and went to sugar colonies, and they could easily be forgotten. They could be swept out of Indian history. Well, you know, now it's getting back onto the stage, and the presence of Rishi Sunak also is interesting in that aspect. So you cannot forget, you know, a country mustn't and can forget where millions of people have gone and the reasons why they have left India in the first place. So this is also a kind of interrogation, you know, about what is happening at the present, in the present.
Yeah. And you've also talked about the development, as if to say, of a new field, which would be called Kalapani studies, much like the Black Atlantic, which is now well established. How would you define the contours of this new field you're proposing?
Yes, the new field, I mean, the Kalapani studies, I mean, has been has been a new field in the diaspora for almost a generation now. I mean, people working, scholars working on the migrations from India towards, you know, Fiji, Mauritius, the Caribbean, South Africa, etc. So those crossings that are part of Kalapani, you know, crossings. But we could also potentially involve all the crossings and migrations to, you know, Malaysia, for instance. This would be another, you know, another field. So for me, it would involve, you know, both the migration outward and potentially, you know, what happens to those migrants, emigrants, immigrants. You know, you have all those words that obviously do not mean the same thing. Now there is a tendency among people to use only the word migrants. But migrants, I mean, it's very different, isn't it, from emigrants or immigrants. Migrants are all over the place. Migrants overwhelm and they become an intrusive force, which was not the case when you use the word emigrant or immigrant. It had a direction. You what knew expects. Where they were leaving. You knew where they were, you know, where they were arriving. Migrants, it reinforces the impression, which is of course very political, reinforces the impression that they are getting everywhere. They are all over the place. They cannot be controlled. There is no direction anymore. You know, so Kalapani crossings, I mean, would be involved with this, you know, these attempts at understanding, understanding the way out and the way back, and also what emerges out of those migrations. What has been germinating? What has been, you know, what has been created? It's also on the creative level and dimension that I would like to put the stress for those, you know, Kalapani crossings. It's, you know, creolization is part of it. This also is very political, because creolization means, you know, all those instances of mixing and métissage, and how you cannot be reduced to one single root. You know, then we're going back to glissant, obviously. There is no one, you know, single route. There are only many origins and a multiplicity of origins. So this, I think, is also what could be interesting in the development of the field, you know, Kalapani crossings. I mean, it's all those aspects that are linked to the migration, but also emphasize the creativity and the realized, you know, creation of something that it's not simply one plus one, obviously. It's the creation of a new element that cannot be summed up, you know, subsumed under simply the addition or the sum of the two previous elements.
Ashutosh, you were adding something. You were saying something when it was about migrants.
No, I just said that there are several times, like you have expats also.
Yeah, expats. Yeah. Coming now, there in the introduction, there is this interesting comparison between the 2020 COVID lockdown in India and what had happened to the economic migrants, the internal migrants, sometimes that as they're called in India. And you have made comparison between these Kalapani crossings and what had happened during the lockdown. I want to understand, how does this comparison help us better understand what had happened in the 19th century?
See, at first, I and Judith, we are making a very bold comparison. We are identifying three major migrations of the last three centuries. 19th century during the Kalapani migrations, 20th century during the partition, and now the COVID migrations. So we are trying to draw certain pattern to it, that in all the three cases, people who were in distress, people who are primarily the victims of the state's inefficiency, even at times their deliberate atrocities, they were forced to migrate from their places. One. Two, it is normally believed that during the Kalapani migrations, mostly lower caste people wanted to migrate to distant shores so as to escape their caste. But that is not true. There are accounts that even Brahmins who were poor, who were impoverished, they also moved to the distant shores. There's a very interesting account by Totaram Saradi himself, that he being a Brahmin, he was asked to conceal his caste while filling the affidavit about his migration and call himself to be a lower caste. So that would make him an easy entry to the vessel. So people who were essentially marginalized, not just caste-wise, but otherwise as well, they were the migrants. And we had seen during the COVID crisis also, a large number of laborers, daily wagers, small shopkeepers who had left their villages, who were working in the metro and capital cities, they were forced to migrate. So this explains, now why does it take place in 22nd century right now? Because of the state's apathy. So this explains what might have happened earlier, two centuries before.
But also, I mean, shifting the perspective, you know, backwards, I mean, once again, in order to be able to understand, I mean, the migrations as they happened, the internal migrations, but also migrations towards, you know, other countries, in order to understand that, you need to keep in mind the Kalapani, you know, crossings and the earlier 19th century migrations. So this is why, I mean, it's, you know, this kind of ongoing conversation between back and forth as well. And so caste oppression is still there, even more probably than, you know, previously in the past. And migrations, I mean, you know, in the middle of the World Cup, we can also mention that and mention, you know, all the migrations from India to the UAE and, you know, Emirates. Yeah. So this is also, this has been, you know, not so big in people's consciousness, but now it's becoming, you know, big in the news because the scandals are so many and so outrageous. But it's, again, it's to flee, you know, hunger and poverty and caste oppression. It's a kind of repetition, you know, tragic repetition of history. And of course, it's made worse when pandemics happen. But it doesn't happen because of the pandemics. The pandemics only reveal what has been going on anyway, you know, so.
One author which has prominently been criticized in the introduction of the book is Naipaul. You have already mentioned Naipaul. Specialist of Naipaul, who I have talked to previously, would say that instances where he has made racist comments or casteist comments do not necessarily imply that he was a racist or casteist. These are examples of him trying to see the world through the diaspora and all the problems that come with it, and then ultimately showing that this fails in the contemporary world. And so there is a need for a shift of perspective from the casteism and the racism. And I'm specifically referring here to the works of Sanjay Krishnan, who was also there for this podcast when he published his V.S. Naipaul's Journeys. Would you agree to this claim, or would you think that Naipaul is someone we should do away with?
Well, I'm sorry I haven't, you know, listened to the podcast you mentioned, and I haven't read Sanjay Krishnan's book. I will definitely do so, but I haven't, you know, so far. In the book, I mean, the chapter by Joshil Abraham is actually, you know, going into great details to quote from a lot of passages and using a lot of excerpts, from Naipaul, that actually tend to show and tend, I mean, I think it's very convincing, tend to show that it's not only, you know, trying to make things from another perspective. I mean, he has this cast lens that he cannot shed, and he has this, Brahmin lens also that he is constantly using. One could have expected him to get into another kind of, perspective and to shed and to get rid of that casteist approach because of the journey across Kalapani and into the diaspora. I don't think this is the case. So I think we need to be even more cautious when we talk about, you know, Naipaul, and when we read him. He is an amazing writer. I mean, definitely. But his political stance, I mean, you know, you can hardly mention his name in the Caribbean because of his political, you know, stances as well, and what he has, you know, written about the Caribbean. And so he had a lot of scorn as well for India, except when it came to, you know, Brahminism and high caste and his own caste that he had to uphold. And in fact, he rediscovered it and reclaimed it through the diasporic journey. This is also what Joshi Labraham tries to demonstrate in his chapter. So instead of helping him to shed his caste, the diasporic journey has re-emphasized it and sort of enhanced it even more.
That ties up with what Ashutosh was saying about the Brahmanization of the diaspora.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Because the works that you have talked about in the books are produced outside India as well as within the subcontinent, I want to understand from you how should literary production outside the country should mean for this country? How should India deal with it, or what should Indian literary production learn from these works?
Well, there is... what is interesting is the fact that those Caribbean, writers, Indo-Caribbean writers, have been increasingly taught at the university level, for instance. So they have been, put on syllabi, and students actually have been reading Ramabai Spinay and so Shani Mutu as well. And what has the book also by Gayatri Bahadur, Coolie Woman, that was a big, it was a bestseller book for, the Indian audience and the global audience. But there seems to be an interest in those writings and those books and poems as well. Probably because it talks back to concerns and issues that are particularly pregnant in India nowadays. That is, again, gender oppression, caste oppression, and seeing how the diasporic Indo-Caribbean women, for instance, have been dealing with patriarchal rules, gender oppression, caste oppression, etc., over there, can also be an inspiration in India. So this is also, my take. And of course, there have been, the writings in Hindi. I mean, Ashutosh mentioned Totaram, for instance. So there were writings in Hindi as well, a few, but maybe it is on the rise as well, potentially.
I would add here, there is a lot that the global diaspora scholarship can learn from the writings in Indian languages. One particular novel I would like to underline here. This is by Ashwani Kumar Pankaj, Mati Mati Arkati. Now, Mati, we know soil. Arkati is a broker. So he draws, in this novel, he draws our attention to a remarkable phenomena, which perhaps most scholarship has ignored so far, that in countries like Guyana, Fiji, Suriname, Tobago, Trinidad and Tobago, the diaspora mostly consists of the Bhojpuri-speaking population. So the people who are at the top there, among the Indian diaspora, they are those who are Bhojpuri ones. In Fiji also, several diaspora scholars also, they trace their origins to the Bhojpuri-speaking areas. Now, what Pankaj tells us in this novel, that among the earliest of the indentured laborers, they were not Bhojpuri-speaking, they were Adivasis from Jharkhand. But as I mentioned about the Brahminization, because in the social hierarchy here in India as well, these Bhojpuri speakers, even though of the lower caste, they were slightly above the Adivasis. When they go to these countries abroad, the Adivasi Girmitiya, the Adivasi laborers, they remain at the lowest pedestal there as well. And their histories, their struggles are completely obliterated from the diaspora literature there. So we see the diaspora scholarship as well as diaspora literature, it's mostly about the Bhojpuri speaking people. What about the Adivasis who went from there? So there is a need to focus on or learn from such works as well, which only dispossessed or marginalized communities in India can write, not the influential people, not among the influential diaspora.
Yeah. What do you hope the readers take from this book?
A shift in perspective, a new gaze, a new understanding of their own country, a revisiting of history as well, which possibly has to bring in a revisiting of one's understanding of the present.
Well, I believe besides this, readers, when they read, when they look at the cover itself, and then they see the two names are from two different continents, they are intrigued to explore such transcontinental relationships which result in such work. Because for me, it's a major event of my life to have this intellectual partnership and this book. So readers, apart from the content of the book, I'm sure, I hope that readers also learn a bit about the making of the book and get some inspiration out of it, because it's been a fascinating process. We had bitter fights also on several issues, but at the same time, it's been a learning.
Absolutely. That was well said. Yes.
So please, or if anybody who is listening to me, please get into more and more such relationships, because these will shake you out of your prejudices, your own comfort zone, than anything else, perhaps. Mm.
Quite so.
Thank you, Judith. Thank you, Ashutosh, for joining me.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Gargi.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.